This audio is a recording of Community Development, Lessons for Social Movements, that was made at Chelmsbury in February 3rd, 2010. The speakers are Mick O'Brien, a researcher and activist who draws on conversations with community activists to look at the practical possibilities opened up by community development, focusing on questions of political subjectivity, biopolitics and movement institutions. The second speaker is Lawrence Cox, who's been an activist for over 25 years. He works with activists studying their own movements and co-edits the Interface Journal dedicated to learning from each other's struggles. His contribution will look at what newer anti-capitalist movements might have to learn from community organising and what community organising might have to learn from anti-capitalism. The discussion was organised by Better Questions, which is an initiative that has emerged out of conversations between people engaged in either social movement practices in Dublin and or thought on radical social change. They have a blog at thought-movements.blogspot.com.
Hey, okay, so we're going to get started. Thanks a lot for coming out tonight. This is the second session of Better Questions seminar series happening here in Chelmsbury. This session is on community development, and it's the second seminar so far. Just to give a bit of background to the idea of Better Questions, it's emerged out of anti-capitalist, anti-authoritarian politics in Ireland, in Dublin mostly, recently, sort of emergence between people involved in these type of politics and also engaged in politically charged social science research. We decided that it would be a useful thing to make use of the fact that a lot of people are engaging in this research and involved in academia to bring ideas that people seem to think are mostly the property of the university and bring it outside and see if we can take something from them to build better cognitive tools for our social movement practices. So the way we've structured the seminars is we've asked people who are conducting research and using these ideas and have expertise in particular areas to come and present these ideas to us so we can, this will hopefully lead on to discussion further. I'll lead you to Mick O'Brien, who's an activist and researcher, and Lawrence Cox, who's an activist and researcher for the last 25 years who's worked a lot in community development projects. We'll follow him, and then we'll lead on to a session of questions and answers. Thanks very much.
Yeah, so just to say a bit about where I'm coming from with what I'm going to say today. I'm not a community activist myself, and I'm not affected by any of the issues that community development would normally engage with. My interest in community development is really in terms of community development as a political movement that developed what I think are some important political concepts and tools. And I suppose I want to reflect on those concepts and tools, and in particular, try to draw them out of their context and explore their relevance for contemporary social movements, especially grassrootsy anti-capitalist type movements, but more broadly as well. When I first got involved in kind of radical social politics or whatever, I was very much an orthodox Marxist, like a lot of people, and I was very much thinking of social change happening in terms of working class struggle and the working class basically taking over the means of production and the state, this kind of setup. And I was very critical of community development. At that point, I knew people who were involved in community development, and we used to talk about this, but I was very critical, and my criticism was very much of the fact that community development didn't have a proper class analysis, that it didn't have a proper critique of capitalism, and that it had a kind of a cozy relationship with the state. Subsequently, though, after kind of years, I suppose, of being involved in different projects, most of the political projects I was engaged in either never got off the ground, collapsed shortly after they started, or were directly counterproductive. So that led me to kind of rethink the whole question. And in particular, I became fascinated, really, with the capacity of community development to become relevant to concrete conflicts and to build real relationships with people from diverse backgrounds who were challenging given issues. So I wanted to kind of think a bit more about how that had happened, how community development achieves that, because I think it would be something that's interesting for social movements, to do as well. In terms of organisational and institutional capacity, community development, or the community sector as it's sometimes called, is obviously very far in advance of social movements at the moment. In terms of the amount of physical, financial, human resources that are available or that are within the community sector is also very far advanced. There's a very high ability to put political issues on the agenda, political issues which probably otherwise wouldn't be on the agenda, and also most importantly to become relevant to those issues and to intervene in them in a concrete way. And that seems to be something that social movements aren't always very good at doing. But in spite of all that, I think it's also fair to say that community development, as a way of thinking about radical social change, is very much in crisis. A recent survey by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation into the future of the community sector found that the issue that community activists themselves identified as being the biggest problem in the future for community development was the inability of the sector or of community development to articulate dissent, the inability to dissent. And I think the community development not being able to express dissent is almost like a communist party not being able to critique capitalism. It fundamentally undermines the basic principles of community development, and in that sense I think it's indicative of the kind of crisis which community development is experiencing. There's also a crisis in community development arising from the massive government cuts in the area over the last year or so. And so I think it's a good time to reflect on community development and on some of these issues. And that's what I'll be doing for the rest of the talk. Just to give a bit of context to the issues I want to focus on, I'm not going to try and give a comprehensive account of community development in Dublin. I'm not going to try and kind of do justice to that whole experience and the complexity of it. I'm really just going to pick out a few issues which I think are central and which I think are useful for us now in a social movement context. In particular, I'm going to focus on the response to drugs and HIV in the South Inner City between around the 80s, mid-80s up until the early 90s, around 1994. And most of what I'll be saying about community development comes from conversations with people who lived and worked in the South Inner City and were instrumental in organising some of the first projects to empower communities to respond to the drug problem and challenge the state. And if we go back to the 70s and 80s and look at the context of the South Inner City at that time, there was a context of absolute exclusion from formal education, from employment, from health services, from housing. And this exclusion was linked to a kind of discrimination, which at times bordered on racism, in which people from certain areas were basically criminalised and considered deviant by definition. And huge proportions of people from those areas were either incarcerated in prisons or in the disciplinary machinery of the Catholic Church. And that's the context during the 80s, then especially, in which heroin emerged as a problem. The state's response to that problem was initially to declare that heroin basically didn't exist, that there was no drug problem in Ireland. And I think this wasn't just about denying the existence of the heroin problem, it was also about denying the existence of people and communities affected by that problem. So you might say that we can think about this as a state strategy a strategy of invisibilization, of making this issue and these people invisible. As the 80s went on, then the state moved to another strategy, which is probably even more emblematic of the state, which was a strategy of criminalisation. And again, I don't think it was just the case of criminalising people who were using heroin, but there was, to a certain extent, it was also about criminalising whole areas or whole communities, and also depoliticising the issue by framing it in law and order terms, by framing it as a question of criminality and deviance. And so it was another way to exclude people, if you like, to exclude them from citizenship or to exclude them from being political actors. I think it's important to think about that context because it allows us to appreciate the significance of the mobilizations and the movement that emerged to challenge that. Particularly, I think, when people took to the streets in relation to the drug problem, it was really important because it was about claiming, as well as responding to the problem, it was also about claiming the right to occupy public space, about claiming the right to name, for communities to name the problem, and to claim the right to kind of put that problem as a public and political issue. So in a way it was a kind of a strategy, or it was a way of resisting the strategy of criminalisation by reframing the problem in more political or social terms. So for somebody like Jacques Rancière, who's a theorist that we're going to be talking about in 2 weeks, that moment of where a kind of a political actor becomes visible and becomes able to name a problem and articulate a response to that problem is a kind of fundamental political moment. And I think that was the case in relation to the mobilizations around drugs. So those kind of mobilizations, that initial kind of that initial moment changed the way the issue, maybe not was perceived, but changed the way it could be perceived. And so it created a possibility for further political action. But to go on to my first kind of concrete point, having talked a little bit about the context, if at this point communities were emerging as kind of political actors or political subjects, what kind of a political subject or a political actor were they? And this is where I think the concept of community becomes very important. And what's most interesting for me is the way that community as a concept provides a new way of thinking about the subjects of radical political action. The dominant way of thinking about collective political action was, and to a large extent still is, the working class. And I think community is interesting because it opens up the possibility of radical political action beyond the working class. Now, some people will dispute this, obviously, and many people would use the term working class communities and would see that as a in-class terms, would see that whole issue in class terms. But in order to say what I mean, I'm going to first just describe how, in my view, Marxist theory understands the concept of class as a way of thinking about a political actor or a political subject that can deliver radical social transformation. So in Orthodox Marxist theory, and in most forms of contemporary Marxist theory as well, the working class is seen, first of all, as an objective group, a group that emerges out of antagonistic relationships between capitalists and producers in the workplace. And through this common experience of the objective economic relations, the working class emerges as a collective political actor. According to Marx's theory, there's nothing kind of automatic about this. The working class has to go from being a class in itself to a class for itself, as Marx said. It has to go from being an objective social category to being a political actor or a political subject. So the job of the revolutionary in all this is to get the workers, basically, to see these objective conditions and to organise resistance to them. as classically laid out in Lenin's What is to be Done and so on. So propaganda and organisation are the basic jobs of the political activist in this scenario. And that way of thinking about, that basic formula for thinking about radical social transformation has obviously been absolutely central to political experiences in many parts of the world for the last couple of centuries. So, or 150 years or whatever. I think community is different to this in a couple of important ways. And some of you have probably seen the Che Guevara films that recently came out. Anyway, in part two, Che goes to Bolivia, where he wants to start the guerrilla struggle. And so he meets the head of the Marxist-Leninist party there to see if the Marxist-Leninist will support the guerrilla struggle. And the leader of the Leninist party says no, because the objective conditions for revolution don't exist. And Che responds to that by saying, kind of, wherever people are hungry, wherever there's unemployment, wherever children are dying, etc., etc., the conditions for revolution exist. And the way I interpret this is that that political action and political subjects don't come out of objective conditions. They can emerge anywhere in response to any issue. And I think community development follows a similar logic, and I interpret it as denying that only the working class can transform society by taking control of the means of production, and arguing that wherever people collectively name a problem and challenge the systemic mechanisms which create that problem, radical change can happen. And I like this because it means our political imagination is no longer trapped within the pseudo-objectivity of orthodox Marxism. And there's another point here, because in relation to this question of how you think about political actors and political subjects and how they come into being, for Marxists, the working class objectively exists. So revolutionaries just have to radicalise something that's already there, basically. In community development, communities don't just exist in themselves. They always have to be built. And so the question of how to create a process of collective political subjectivization becomes a key issue for the activist. Basically, actually building communities ourselves. And that becomes part of the work, if you like, of the activist. And so this idea that political subjectivization flows from people's desire or need to respond to the world around them collectively, rather than from objective economic conditions, is, to my mind, one of the most significant lessons we can draw from community development. That's the kind of first concrete point, the concept of community. Now, to move on to the kind of forms of political action which did then emerge, obviously one response was for communities to try and protect themselves from some of the worst elements of what was going on at the time, the famous pushers out marches and other stuff that went on. I'm not going to talk about that end of this issue. I want to focus on some projects which emerged around HIV and heroin and the exclusion from health. So there's a number of issues here. I think these projects and activists were first of all concerned to respond to this problem in an immediate way, because obviously with something like heroin or HIV, a future revolution isn't of any use. But it also, in the context that these movements also were forced to or managed to analyse the relationship between the body, health, the state, and social exclusion, this kind of complex interplay of factors, which was at the heart of what was going on. And this is what we can call, if you like, the biopolitical dimension. Now, in the last seminar, Ranit Lenton drew on the Foucauldian concept of biopolitics to talk about state racism. And she pointed out that the modern state, unlike other political formations, intervenes directly into the biological life of the population. It regulates reproduction, epidemics, vaccination, sanitation, and millions of other things. Okay, that's what Foucault calls biopolitics. Needless to say, this isn't just about enhancing welfare, as social democrats would have us believe. This is also about regulating the biological life of the population and controlling the population through these biological or biopolitical interventions. And in that process, what has been typical of that process in the 20th century especially, is that people who are considered a danger to the health of the population or superfluous are systematically excluded from state biopolitics, from welfare and so on. Usually this is the kind of usual list of deviants: the disabled, queers, the insane, blacks, etc., etc. And Renée gave a good example of this in the seminar when she talked about the citizenship referendum in 2004, in which the state argued that we needed to tighten citizenship controls in order to by excluding non-Europeans. And one of the reasons the state gave was that African women were coming in and having babies all over the place, a familiar racist motif. At the same time, the immigration control platform was arguing that migrants coming into the country were spreading diseases and as such represented a threat to the health of the population. So in these kind of racist arguments, the key problems are considered to be reproduction and contagion, being contagious, okay? And obviously reproduction, the question of reproduction and the question of contagion are two basic components of all biological life. So it's a way of imagining, it's a way of intervening in these areas through the ideology of protecting the population. That's just an example of the way the state tries to control populations and makes exclusion happen through biopolitics. But going back to the issue of HIV and heroin, a similar kind of set of mechanisms were at work. People affected by those problems, when they tried to access health service, were excluded quite systematically. And this was very much connected to the criminalisation of these communities and this issue. As people said at the time, if the heroin and HIV was happening in any other community in Dublin, it would have been a national emergency. But these communities were excluded from the biopolitics of the welfare state. And to give some examples of this, the state refused to set up needle exchanges where people could exchange needles that they'd used for clean needles. And it refused to do that because it claimed that that would be to kind of encourage this criminal deviant behaviour. So, in other words, the question was framed first of all and primarily as a criminal an issue rather than as a health issue, rather than in terms of the state's citizens' right to health services. Another example would be the state drug treatment centres obliging women to take contraception before they could get on a methadone programme, the implication being that they must be prevented from reproducing. And apparently as well in the US, female drug users were sterilised. I think that was during the 70s. Another example would be one community activist told me of somebody he knew, a prisoner who was in advanced stages of HIV and AIDS-related illness, and was handcuffed to his hospital bed, and monitored by two prison guards at all times, despite the fact that he was in very advanced stages of HIV/AIDS. So the implication again is that this person is first of all a threat to the population, and only second of all, if at all, a citizen with rights in relation to health services and so on. So there was loads of others, for example, medical staff refusing to deal with people who were affected by this problem, or funeral homes refusing to deal with the funerals, and so on. Now, politically, traditional political movements, with some exceptions like feminism, obviously, have ignored the question of health and the body. For example, nationalist and socialist movements either ignore the issue altogether or simply see it as a question of taking over the state and then through the state administering better health. What the analysis developed around marginalised communities and HIV can show us, however, is that state biopolitics is exclusionary, hierarchical, and based on the authority of experts, knowledges, whatever. And what I find inspiring then is that community development tries to intervene directly into this situation, rather than postponing the whole question into some imaginary future in which we take over the state. Community development tries to intervene directly into the problem. And there's two dimensions that I think are useful to think about that. Two ways I think that are useful to think about this. First of all, community development as an approach to this doesn't, in my view, this is a question of interpretation to a certain degree, but this is what came out of the conversations that I had with community activists anyway. In my view, community development avoids seeing the issues like this as merely a symptom of capitalism. And recognises the importance of something like this in itself, in particular as a field of power relations in itself, rather than just a symptom or a reflection of something that's happening elsewhere in the society, for example in production, in the economy and so on. And then the second element of this, so community development develops an analysis of what's going on there in its own terms, rather than as a reflection of a broader capitalist system, etc., etc. Secondly, community development tries to intervene directly into this field of power relations in an unmediated way, as in not through the state, but to go directly into this field of power relations and to create an alternative therein, right? So, community development projects created alternatives to state biopolitics, exclusionary biopolitics, by creating projects which were in which the experiences of people affected by heroin and HIV were incorporated into the political process, into the whole process, in which health was treated as a political rather than a biological problem. And also by critiquing and challenging expert knowledges and moralising discourses, and by empowering people through education, training, and so on. And this capacity to intervene directly into this and provide a concrete alternative to biopolitics, I think that's profoundly significant. But this brings me to my final point, which relates to how community development actually went about creating this real alternative. And I think one way to think about that is to think about the role of what I'm going to call institutions, movement institutions or community institutions. I use the term institutions to refer to stable, continuous organisational forms which make possible permanent and concrete interventions. So community development basically creates a whole series of these institutions which are based in communities which have all sorts of, I don't want to call them services, right, but services is the word that's used, but different forms of welfare basically that people can have access to, and which function in a very different way from the state welfare, which we've already seen was exclusionary. And so in developing these institutions, again, there's two elements that I think are crucial. First of all is you get something through the institution which allows you to intervene directly into a concrete problem, to respond and to provide a concrete alternative to that problem. That's, I think, deeply significant, and it's something that we haven't been terribly good at doing in the social movements, in the anti-capitalist social movements. But second of all, community development tries to develop the type of institution, a type of organisation, which, as well as responding to the concrete problems, also actually does the work of building community, does the work of what I called earlier political subjectivisation. So you get the idea is that through community institutions or community organizations, people come together, and in those spaces they build there's a process of collectively analyzing the problems that are confronting people, of building social networks, and through training and education as well, of empowering people. So you have an institution which is doing two things. It's allowing you to intervene in a concrete problem, and it's building communities of resistance, which is the process of politicization or political subjectivization that's crucial to community development. So there are the kind of three issues that I think we can draw from community development and that I think could be used well within social movements. Unfortunately, as we know, community development's kind of ideal of autonomous community institutions which built communities of resistance and provided a concrete alternative didn't really work out like that. Key issues of autonomy or independence and building communities of resistance fell by the wayside. Community organisations became increasingly trapped in a cycle of seeking funding, delivering services. And most tragically and importantly, the state was able to appropriate the network of community institutions which emerged in the 80s and 90s. So in this sense, we can think of a third state strategy in relation to this issue. First of all, invisibilisation, then criminalisation, and then appropriation. Appropriation happened through strategies of new urban governance, partnership, consensus, the NGO structure, funding criteria, etc., etc. And I think that's also another issue that really needs to be analysed, because a lot of those mechanisms that came out of that period, various kind of partnership forums and various networks and task forces and so on and so forth, those mechanisms are still really important in governing what happens in Dublin today, that kind of network approach to governing the city. So that's pretty much all I have to say. Just to recap on the three key issues. First of all, it's the idea of what I consider to be a post-class conception of political subjectivity. The idea that all of us can become the protagonists of radical social change, and this depends on our desire to create change and to build communities of resistance. The second one is the question of direct intervention. Recognise the importance of intervening in and analysing problems directly as a field of power relations which are significant in themselves. And that, of course, doesn't mean ignoring capitalism by any stretch of the imagination. And the last one is the idea of autonomous institutions, the idea of building institutions by and for communities of resistance to respond to concrete problems here and now, and to provide a tangible alternative to provide a tangible alternative, and also which will also function as machines of radical political subjectivization which enable us to build communities of resistance. So that's that. Thanks for your attention.
Okay, I'll start by disavowing something Hillary said at the start. No fault of your own, but I don't work in community development organisations, but for the last dozen years or so, I've been lucky enough to be in pretty systematic dialogue with some very good working class community activists. So most of what I'm saying is coming out of that dialogue, but like Mick, I'm mostly coming from, I suppose, what these days we're calling the anti-capitalist side of things. Obviously, anti-capitalism is not restricted to the kind of movements that congregate in Shomer. I'll just mention a couple of other empirical bits that I think may be important to the story, and then I'll get into what I want to do, which is mostly to take turns at slagging off one movement from the side of the other, and then turn around and do that. So what's wrong with anti-capitalism from, or what anti-capitalists could learn from community development that put it in a friendly, constructive way, and vice versa, and see if I can say something useful in both cases. But just three little bits of background first. Firstly is the scale of community development in Ireland, which you would easily miss if your impression of working class communities came from British or American TV. In the middle of the 90s, something like half the population of Fatima Mansions were in a community organisation. Something like 4% of the population of Ballymun were employed in a community organisation. We're talking about a very, very large-scale social movement by the terms of most of what we're used to. More easily seen as kind of a junior sister in scale to things like the GAA, the church, the trade union movement, than a sort of minor comparison to contemporary anti-capitalist movements. But secondly, that's a bit weird because what I said about Britain and America, this is not a universal phenomenon. It's not a universal phenomenon in Western societies that scale of working class community organising exists. It certainly exists in Ireland. It exists in the North, of course, in very different forms. We find it in Britain and America, particularly in ethnic minority communities, and we find it in some bits of the Third World, in Latin America, for example, in quite a large scale. I don't have any very grand theory to explain why it appears where it appears, and there may not be a neat answer to that, except to say that there are different histories, and that part of what we're talking about is the history of how working class people in contexts which are constantly being remade by capitalism responds to their situation. So in the 50s and 60s, what we might slightly caricature as traditional communities in Dublin's inner city, which of course still exist, were nevertheless in very large part gutted and their populations dumped in places like Ballymun. One of Europe's largest estates, incidentally, with a population about the size of Wexford, so like 20,000. And when that happened, communities which were quite used to working together in particular ways had to rethink what they were doing. And this was a period in which there were a lot of other ideas coming in from liberation theology, from the new radical movements of the 1960s. And there was a process of rethinking, what do we do? We have these immediate problems. How do we organise to face them? Because suddenly we don't know our neighbours anymore. Our neighbours are not our relatives. We don't automatically jump up street by street and do what we're used to doing. And that process, there was a lot of thinking went into it. It became quite formalised. And part of that formalisation involved state accreditation for a lot of this knowledge, and the state ultimately producing quite a bit of it through, for example, courses in community education and so on. So there are now crises in that as well. So there's a constant process of learning and changing and running up against brick walls and going, what do we do now, and trying to move on, which, you know, of course, is characteristic just of what people do. But I think that's important to say that when we're talking about, as I want to, working class people in the Republic organising in community terms, we're talking about the process and something which is not always the same as what the state calls community development, or what community development means in rural settings, or other things with the word community in them, that there is a lot of fuzziness, and the fuzziness is part of the picture. Okay, so that's the blurb. And, yeah, as I said, I've spent much of the last decade or so having fairly minor conversations around the side, trying to talk to community activists about certain things and trying to bring what they know into conversations within autonomous, anti-capitalist, what have you, situations. And it's a peculiar kind of conversation. I think it is a conversation between social movements. I think it's a mistake to think that community organising is not a social movement. It's a very different kind, in the same way that the labour movement is a very different kind of movement. And that's much a large part of the problem, that you're not comparing like with like. The organisational forms aren't the same, the cultures aren't the same, and even the ability, when you try to get everybody in a room, you find that the ideas of what it means to be in a room, or who should go in the room, or what we should do when we get in there, are chalk and cheese. One of the good sides, of course, is being in a crisis, is that sometimes in a crisis you see just how bad things are, and it gives you a chance to rethink that. Just to say two things about that crisis. Community organisations, having, as Mick said, largely tied themselves to state funding, have spent the last few years seeing the state going, exactly who is going to be upset if we withdraw your funding? And they've gone from a period of kind of radical large-scale direct action to being largely accredited state-funded service providers, and they have no very good answer to that. And it's a bit of a problem. And there's also a problem of generational renewal, where there's a bit of a sense of, well, where's the kids, where's the next generation, where is our political future coming from? Conversely, those of us who've spent the last 10 years trying to organise against neoliberalism and indeed partnership, at some level we've kind of won the argument and lost the war. That's maybe obvious enough, I don't need to go into it in greater detail, but we should be in a better place than we are right now if what we thought we were doing was along the right lines. So we have some kind of problem, and we don't quite know what it is either. So this dialogue, which really are just reflecting conversations that I've had, is certainly not saying there is somebody who has the right answer, because I think, in a sense, the situation is that there is a big problem. Right, what can anti-capitalist, libertarian, new movements mostly made up of people under 40 and so on learn from community organising? Well, I think one thing is the what we could call the Marcos moment. The moment when this pack of Maoists, or whatever they were, from Mexico City University, went out to the jungle all fired up to motivate the peasants, and found that actually the peasants had a rather different sense of who they were. They thought of themselves as Indios or Mayan or whatever, and they felt they'd actually been resisting quite well for the last 500 years, thank you very much. And we could have a very useful dialogue and something very interesting could come out of it, but how come you hadn't noticed our existence previously, in a sense? And, you know, I imagine Mick, certainly I've had that experience at various points. And it's one which I've seen reflected quite often in our movements, that many of us, in inverted commas, actually don't know what the self-organisation of working class people looks like when we see it. It doesn't look like what we expect it to be, or we're quite comfortable with it somewhere else, but when we actually meet it on our doorstep in Dublin, it's disconcerting and it's hard to understand. And I have a little list here of grievances that community activists have had when I've, you know, brought them into our spaces, and the ways people have talked to them or misunderstood or whatever. But much of it boils down to sheer snobbery, and the assumption that either because you're in possession of a university degree, or because you read the newspapers, or because you're on top of radical theory, you know everything that's worth knowing about the world. And, of course, we live in a country where there's a very long, kind of hidden history of working class thinking, working class discussion, only a fraction of which ever kind of makes it through the Marxist or come to that Republican literature to a point where the kind of activist I'm described, which of course is me, can recognise it as, oh yeah, this is theory. So there's a problem of communication between different kinds of theory and different kinds of ways of doing things. And there is a class aspect to that, because separate from where you come from, yeah, that's not really what's the point, but what's involved in becoming a member of the new middle class, the service class or whatever, is controlling a particular kind of knowledge, knowing how to operate a certain kind of form, and on the basis of that, getting into a certain kind of position of power. And we quite often do that within our own movements. So there's quite a bit of snobbery, of a particular kind, an intellectual snobbery. There's quite a bit of, you don't use the right language, you're not radical enough, a whole set of things that have to do with saying who's better than who. And I think one of the big things that we can learn from community activists is not to think of other people like that. I don't just mean not to think of community activists like that, but no good activist that I've worked with thinks like that, either about people in their own communities or about people outside. It's a different way of working, which is not about setting up who are the better people, who are the most radical people. That, of course, does not include bitching about people and feeling that you're right and other people are wrong and all the rest of it. But it is a different way of thinking about what is a good way of moving forward. And it's one which is more geared to how can we bring people with us? How can we start from where people actually are and move them a little bit, not in a manipulative way, but help them to move, than we have sat down and thought what the perfect model for organising is, and anybody who doesn't want to do it with us, well, we know what to think about them. Yeah. I am caricaturing here, of course. I mean, we're not that bad either, but we have some overtones of that, and sometimes they come out, particularly when we're dealing with people who we don't understand, who are coming from a different world, and whose existence, in a sense, we're not really aware of. And it is weird that on the one hand there's a whole body of people who are bang alongside the thought of, you know, working class self-organisation in emancipatory ways, and that there actually are a lot of people doing that, and that the communication between the two is so tenuous and so problematic. Yeah, I mean, I could say more about that, but I think that is one of our biggest problems, not only in relation to community development. I'm not simply saying, if only we could be different people, we could have better conversations. I think we need to, and keep on trying to do so. But saying that this is probably true more generally, and it's probably something that we can learn. In part because this may be a flight of fancy, but we're in the situation, many of us, where we can choose to be in our movements or not. They are a leisure activity, maybe an immensely demanding leisure activity, or they are a style, maybe a style with which we identify hugely. But actually, it is possible to walk away from them. I don't mean it's never possible to walk away from working class communities, as people do so, of course. But there's a different orientation that you have to people if you say, OK, I actually have to live with these people. I actually have to get on, and I'm stuck in this space, and what we do affects back on me. And I remember talking to a famous socialist who will not be named, who was about to go on strike in his university, and he was saying much the same, that, but, you know, I've organised loads of strikes, but it feels very different when it's your own workplace. And a whole set of different calculations come into play when you realise this is my boss and my job and my colleagues, and I don't know what way it's going to play out. Even though, of course, you know, at the end of the day, it'll be very well. So there's something there to learn for us, particularly at this point where we've hit that kind of brick wall of you know, we thought we were saying something sensible. Actually, you know, I think history says we were saying something sensible, but it didn't somehow get through. And obviously, you know, there are all sorts of other reasons why it didn't get through. But we didn't, perhaps, and we still don't, have the kind of breadth of people with us that our theory would suggest. And turning it around and saying, well, what can community organisation learn from anti-capitalism? I kind of agree with Mick that one of the big things is just don't trust the state. And it's not rocket science, but it is quite important. An experience which has been shared both by black and Latino communities in the States and by the communities in South Africa which supported the ANC is that institutionalisation and relying on the state, whether you win or not, has all sorts of strange effects on movements. Most obviously, it demobilises them, because what you wind up doing is creating a relatively small elite who are able to deal with the state, who can go to meetings, practically can go to meetings, but also have the skills to be there effectively, can do the policy papers, can make the funding proposals, can get the accreditation, whatever it is, and a bunch of others who increasingly, when the state turns around and says, we're going to shut you down, it's only a handful of projects which have been able to effectively resist that. Most of them haven't. And there was an aspect of failed learning there, because some of the places where people were coming from, some of the ideas that people drew on to develop kind of Irish community activism as it is, were sort of a little bit too consensual, particularly the kind of Catholic versions. A lot of them were quite state-focused, those who were coming from kind of Republican and socialist positions. There was a tendency to think, not necessarily to think that the state was actually on their side because people weren't thick, but to think that it could be, or that it should be, or that somehow this would be possible without a much bigger battle. And of course we're actually talking about a period of retreat, because we were talking about the 70s and the 80s, in which the proposition that the state will be on the side of the working class has become less and less plausible. Even while it has been increasingly plausible that the state would sit there and nod wisely while you talked about inclusion and diversity, and would even give you a little bit of funding to run a little project somewhere about it. And in a sense, it's a sign of the movement's bankruptcy that as things have hit this wall, so many of its brightest brains are still working on desperate ways to save social partnership and proposals for what could be done if only Fianna Fáil were to take a different line on the crisis. This kind of carry-on. And there's only really been a handful of serious attempts to go, how do we get out of this situation beyond just kind of going, okay, we've got our backs to the wall in this community, we'll fight here, which is fine, but limited. Well, I'll say just two things maybe and then shut up, because discussion is probably more useful at this point. It's quite difficult to be a social movement, to do a social movement, to make things happen. We are under all sorts of kinds of pressure and we have to get on with each other, and often there is a trade-off between doing what we have agreed we're going to do in the way we've agreed we're going to do it and stepping back and going, is this working? So there is a big, big bootstrap problem which I think both kinds of movement are facing at the moment. You can't simply throw everything overboard and say, right, well, our organisations are crap, our theory is crap, our way of doing things is crap, let's dissolve ourselves and start again from zero. It wouldn't happen even if you said it. But you also can't simply carry on as though everything was fine. And this obviously is one of those crisis and opportunity moments, which is not saying anything very profound. What I did want to suggest, and I'll make this as a practical suggestion, is that there will be something to be said for seeing if it was possible, not just between our movements, because there are other movements which have reached similar kinds of impasse. Trying to get relatively large numbers of us, maybe 100 people together somewhere outside Dublin, in the country, whatever, for a couple of weeks. Not with a programme of talks by famous speakers, not with something has to come out of this, but with can we actually learn something when we are spending enough time in each other's company to relax about our own mistakes, to learn from other people's mistakes, and to see is there anything that we know collectively that we may not know individually in our own movements. That specific suggestion may not be the most helpful thing, but I think we need, in some form, some way of getting outside the routines of our own movements, because, frankly, they are not working. And I'll leave it at that.
The following was originally given at the start of this talk. I've moved it to the end to keep the introduction brief.
The last session, there was a few questions over how we organised it, why we hadn't asked particular people. It was a session on state racism, and people were curious about why we hadn't actually asked people who were involved in working in these areas. And like, we could have done that, and there's no preventing us from doing it in the future, but we wanted to start by asking people who were involved in research in these areas to begin discussions that touch on theory and that touch on social science research, and that's the motivation behind this particular seminar series. Following that, we're going to have a roundtable discussion on praxis. The idea is to get a sort of a broad understanding of theories and research that relate to the creation of knowledge within social movements.
This audio is a recording of Community Development, Lessons for Social Movements, that was made at Chelmsbury in February 3rd, 2010. The discussion was organised by Better Questions, which is an initiative that has emerged out of conversations between people engaged in either social movement practices in Dublin and or thought on radical social change. They have a blog at thought-movements.blogspot.com. There is a second recording of the questions and answers that followed this session. That was about 30 minutes long. It'll be posted as a comment on the IndieMedia article this was originally posted to, which you'll also find it at anarchism.pageabode.com. The recording and editing was done by Andrew Flood. You'll find more articles and also more recordings I've done at anarchism.pageabode.com/user/AndrewNFlood.